Welcome to Honorverse Today, the Honor Harrington podcast brought to you by TPE Network. Let's be about it.
Hello there, Honorverse fans. Welcome to our next problematic episode of Honorverse Today. This is Roel Wybera, your host, joined by my co-hosts and good friends, Jim Arrowood and J.P. Harvey. How are the two of you this fine, well, in St. Louis, wet day?
I'm doing great.
Same here.
Hopefully we'll get through this recording and keep our internet connection at my end. It's a little stormy.
Uh-oh.
Which is kind of fitting. yeah. We're going to hit what I suspect is going to be one of the more problematic books of the series tonight, folks. And I'm going to tell you guys both now. I wrote this with the word problematic in my notes before what I'm going to make a reference to later toward the end of the book, just so you know.
Okay.
Now, our longtime listeners might remember that I've warned the guys about a particular book coming that was going to be hard to follow, and you'd probably need a Polish lexicon next to you if you were wanting to get through it. Jim's chuckling. Yeah, he remembers. I think he remembers my saying that.
I think you probably warned us three or four different times.
Yeah, several times.
This is that book.
And you weren't wrong.
Most of this book, one of the things that makes it hard to follow is most of this book is parallel action that has been happening over the course of the last several books, actually several years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of an attempt to bring all three of the arcs back together. And I'm not going to say any more at this point because it's going to end up being a big part of the discussion. So instead, I am going to turn this over to you, Jim, for a summary.
Okay, I'll do the best I can here. The Mason alignment is revealed. And for Honor Harrington and the Manticorn star system, this means war. Unintended consequences. Sometimes things don't work out exactly as planned. The Mason Alignment has a plan, one it's been working on for centuries. A plan to remake the galaxy and genetically improve the human race its way. Until recently, things have gone pretty much as scheduled, but then the Alignment hit a minor bump in the road called the Star Empire of Manticore. So the Alignment engineered a war between the Solarian League, the biggest and most formidable interstellar power in human history, and the Star Empire, and to push things along, the Alignment launched a devastating sneak attack which destroyed the Royal Manticoran Navy's industrial infrastructure. And in order to undercut Manticore's galaxy-wide reputation as a star nation of its word, it launched Operation Janus, a false flag covert operation to encourage rebellions it knows will fail by promising Manticoran support. The twin purposes are to harden Solarian determination to destroy the Star Empire once and for all, and to devastate the Star Empire's reputation with the rest of the galaxy. But even the best laid plans can have unintended consequences, and one of those consequences, in this case, may be a new dawn of freedom for oppressed star nations everywhere. Well, there it is.
There it is.
Yeah. JP, so, go ahead, Jim.
Oh, I was just going to send JP over to the special notes.
Yeah, so this chunky novel was published by Ban in November of 2016, and it is the conclusion of the Saganami Island story arc.
At this point, at least.
At this point. As far as we know, it's 756 pages, and the events take place from approximately February of 1921 to October of 1922 PD.
And it feels a whole lot longer than that.
Yeah. 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 That year and a half was the longest decade of my life. But let's roll right into some overall impressions. And Jim, I'll ask you to kick us off.
Okay. I did not enjoy this book for the most part. I didn't get a lot out of it, even if it does intertwine with Shadows of Freedom. There were a lot of things that turned me off, and finishing it was a slog fest. It wasn't without its brighter moments, though, you know, but those were just kind of all too brief and too few for me. How about you, JP?
Well, I was prepared to say, so I'll say it, even though you're, it sounds like you and I are on the same page. I was going to tear the Band-Aid off right away, get it out of the way. I didn't like this book. I'm open to the charge that I missed the obvious reading it, but the first half of the book, to me, was pretty horrible, and I'm not sure I can even tell you what happened, other than there was too much Polish, and I'm kind of comparing that to other languages we've seen as we've read through the Univers. People were slinking around being underhanded. Sometimes I'm a fan of that. I knew that it was going on. And there were some soccer matches. But I really can't tell you what happened. Nothing seemed tied to anything else. And I'm not talking about seeing where this book is covering ground that was covered differently in other books. So it's not that. But here's my overall impression. If it wasn't for this podcast, I would have put the book down and walked away from it long before I hit chapter 36.
Hear, hear.
And chapter 36.
That's the midpoint, right?
I'll come around to that. Yeah. For context, I've only ever done that, meaning walk away, with a handful of books in my entire life. I literally went back and looked at the info on this book several times to confirm there wasn't a co-author involved. I wanted so badly to blame whoever that person was for what I was reading, but there wasn't one listed. I was virtually certain, and I honestly still want to believe, that David couldn't have written the first half of this book. Maybe there was another secret author who David graciously allowed to take a shot at writing in the Univers. And protected him or her by not putting their name on it. But that's about all I can do to make sense of what I read. And I brought up chapter 36 because the book changed at chapter 36, which is about the halfway point of the book. And more on that later. But I just smeared that booger on everyone. So I'm going to hand off to you, Raul.
All right. Like I said earlier, I had warned you about a particular book coming, and that this is that one. I've read it two or three times before this official podcast reading.
You got more fortitude than I have.
Well, okay. Actually, this will be in my final thoughts. First of all, in all honesty, this was the only one that was hard to get through. In the other cases where David has done the parallel stories across a stretch of time, he's pulled it off. I don't think it worked this time, and particularly along with the lines of what you've said and also what I understand from elsewhere, particularly in the first half. The book takes yet another approach to the craziness on the verge. In this case, there's a strong linkage to the modern historical Eastern European bloc, and that should be a good theme. In concept, it should have worked. And just when you get past that Polish lexicon that I was talking about, you get hit with Czech.
Yeah.
Your brain might just explode here.
You know, and you know the problem? There aren't enough vowels.
The second half of the book, though, is actually not that bad. The problem is that by the time you get there, My concern for new readers is you might be too disillusioned to appreciate that second half. And it sounds like that fits both of you gentlemen in some ways. There's some very important things happening in the second half. Final flourish. Some of the stuff setting up with the Mason alignment, some of the things that Mike is doing to help the effort, you know, the consolidate and deal with the Salarian leak. But that's largely all second half material. Damien Harahap, a lot of the significant development, second half of the book, basically all the good parts. And that's really the main reason to read the book. And for the record, that's what got me through the other times.
Yeah.
The magic. The second half has got one of the best for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There was a change.
Chapter 36 is that's the point. When I saw that after I had written my notes, JP, I actually went back. Yeah. 36. He's got exactly the right. That's the changeover point. Mm. The book has got the best pair up in the entire series here. Lester Tourville and Michelle Henke.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, you can't get a better ship than that.
Yeah, that's one of the bright spots.
Yep, and we get the final battle of Mesa. Victor and oh gosh, my brain just broke.
And that other guy.
And Anton?
Yeah. Anton, thank you. where all of that resolves. I guess I just made the blooper reel, Jim.
Yeah.
I'll go ahead and say something now, since you had mentioned it here, from my final thoughts. The trick to getting through this book on reread, first of all, this book on rereads actually goes better. You're much more forgiving on the reread than on the initial reading. And I think that's because you know where to skim and where to, okay, actually stop and enjoy the book.
Fortunately, I won't be finding that out.
But on the reread, it's actually much, much easier to get through and to be forgiving of, because it's like, wait a second, I'm not going to worry about the Polish. I'm not going to worry about the Czech. I'm going to get to the good parts that I care about when I reread the story.
Well, this took me an entire month to get through.
Oh, gosh.
The whole month was taken up by mm-hmm. this book.
Yeah, the book itself seems less like a single novel and more like several short stories and a novella that have got chopped up and interwoven.
Yeah, in a Cuisinart.
Yeah.
And just for the record, I did warn Dave that, okay, the boys aren't going to be too happy on this one. And his comment was, yeah, of the entire series, this book was the most problematic.
Yeah.
And he just jokingly said, maybe I shouldn't have included the Czech. Maybe the Czech and the Polish together was a little too much.
Well, you know, and as I read through this thing, I would copy the names and paste them into Google and ask it to pronounce things them. For me. And it just started turning into word salad. That added to the time trying to get through this.
Yeah, and that's what really piled up the heavy frustration.
Yeah, so.
Well, let's talk about the story.
Let's talk about the story.
Because there was a story behind all this.
Yeah, for the most part, yes. Okay, so I have some notes here that are greatly truncated, and I've also gone month by month, and I found a timeline for events. So I added those in to kind of give things maybe something we're more familiar with.
Yeah. Okay. I think this is going to be a good approach to walking through what happened.
Yeah. What I'm going to do is just read. And if there's some point you guys want to talk about, just cut me off. All right.
We'll do it.
This is February 1921. Post-diaspora. Damien Harahap of the Salarian League is attacked. A mysterious stranger intervenes on his behalf, and the stranger arranges for Damien to be taken to a safe house where he's told to await further instructions. Other events during that month included the Battle of Monica and the release of Mike Henke, who acts as an envoy to Elizabeth from Haven's President Pritchard. Okay.
And that was good, because right out of the shoot, we had anchor points to things that we had previously read.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep.
That was cool.
Yeah.
And there's going to be some significant stuff happening with Harahap in the future.
Okay.
That's he is going to be a more important character than you realize.
All right. This would be March 1921 PD. On Vlach Klavek, an Airbus with 123 students and teachers is shot down when trying to land to tour a facility, causing unrest among the population. The reports from the government try to minimize the tragedy. There is a revolution being planned there also, but the rebels do not have the resources they need to carry out their plans. Meanwhile, Corvisart meets with the Royal Manticoran Navy and commanders about the Monacan situation to decide what roles will be played by whom. Damien is still at a safe house. Chernyshev explains that his bosses want to meet with him about doing the same work he did in Talbot, and he is open to their offer.
Sort of. It's like, I'm getting the feeling that this is an offer you can't refuse. You won't live through refusing.
Yeah. It's an offer you don't want to refuse. Okay, April 1921 PD. Violence is breaking out in many places with varying degrees of violence.
Violence.
Yeah. On Chotoborsh, young people are attacked and killed by the local safety force. Officials worry that when word of the incident gets out, there will be escalating violence. Adam Semel is considered to be someone who could help quiet the situation. An attempted assassination of Barry Zielwicki by the Mason alignment fails, while an attempt against James Webster succeeds. Elizabeth cancels a planned meeting with Pritchard, and Manticore resumes hostilities with Haven.
This is time sinking because yes. All of these events that are events that we've seen elsewhere.
Yes. Damien Harpap meets with Anisimovna and Bardasano of the Mason alignment.
We got to see some more of them. That was one of the pluses, actually.
Yes.
I like those two characters.
Yes. He is told about Operation Janus. They are worried that other systems in the sector will be tempted to join the Manticoran Empire. Damien is offered the job of meeting with rebel factions in the sector and offering them assistance with their efforts in the name of Manticore. Manticorans discover a chip containing information on Solarian League ships and information on the Monica incident. It is a major coup for Manticore. Okay. June 1921 PD. Damien begins his mission. His efforts are beginning to show results. The Solarians get wind of something going on in the sector and think that Manticore is involved in rising unrest. However, they aren't sure. They don't have any positive evidence. Okay. And also, I think in the same month, the Battle of Lovat, Admiral Javier Giscard is killed. Okay. Now, this one I wasn't exactly sure about. I don't think I had a month, but I kind of guessed here. July 1921 AD. Okay, so I'm just going to add a note here. My Kindle copy of this, just a note here, in my Kindle copy of this book, this chapter was labeled as anti-diaspora. I think it was a mistake in the manuscript, and according to the timeline, it should have been post-diaspora.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I saw that same thing, and did a double take, but the events didn't seem like it was a look back to the past. So
yeah,
I assume that was just a goof in the book.
I think so. All right. So, Tarakov gets the Hexapuma to Hephaestus for repairs. Later, after being reunited with his wife, Sinead, he is informed he will be sent back to Talbot as a commodore of a squadron aboard the St. James.
I got to add, That was one of the other really bright points of the book for me. Anything that has Sinead Tarakov in it. I love her. I really love that character.
Yeah. I would count this among the bright points.
Her and Ginger together.
Yeah. Okay. Damien continues to search for planets ripe for rebellion, as well as those that offer the most success. And during this time also, the Battle of Manticore happened.
The first battle.
Yeah. Okay. August 1921 PD, Damien has been successful in his mission and with Operation Janus and has identified the places Mesa will provide weapons to. He is elevated from being a prospector to being a handler. This follows the death of Anna Samovna, I believe. He begins to move to various places to make arrangements for delivery of promised supplies. There are numerous discussions taking place all over the sector. A lot of yakety yak going on. And in other news, October 1921 PD, the Battle of Torch, Admiral Bing of the Solarian League attacks the Manticorans at New Tuscany. Okay, November 1921 PD, Zilwicki and Kasha escape with Simois after a nuclear detonation on a mesa. It is blamed on the ballroom and further Manticore as well. Damien is given another promotion to oversee operations on Vla Klavek and Swallow. The SLN Task Group 3021 is disabled by Mike in command of the 10th Fleet. December 1921 PD, the situation on Loomis escalates when most of the McCrory group are killed in an attack designed to cripple the rebellion there. The Mason Alignment, in other news, launches Operation Oyster Bay. Mm-hmm. And we all remember that.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay, January 1922 PD, meetings and discussions ad infinitum.
There you go. That's fair.
Yep. Okay. February 1922 PD, the Mason Alignment executes Operation Oyster Bay. Many ships are obliterated and 2 million people are killed. Overthrows are in various stages of operations around the sector. The Solarian League are beginning to think that Manticore is right in their claims that they are being manipulated into conflict. Ginger Lewis takes command of a ship, and in other news, the Battle of Spindle. All of Manticoran merchant ships are recalled from the Solarian League.
And I think we're getting close to getting into the newer kind of storyline.
Yeah.
And shiny moment that Ginger gets a command.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. April 1922 PD. Manticore has restricted Solarian League access to the wormholes, and the Masons are concerned it will cause a crisis for the League. The League is also looking forward to getting new missile technology from Mesa, and there are developments on rebel activity all around the sector. May and June 1922 PD, Damien continues to assure his clients that Manticoran help will arrive on the scene as they are needed. The Mason Alignment accelerates the implementation of Operation Houdini. Violence in the sector becomes more frequent and violent thanks to Mason weapons. In other news, Haven President Pritchard makes a surprise visit to Manticore, fostering an end to the war and an alliance of military cooperation between the former enemies. Benjamin Mayhew of Grayson arrives at Manticore to sign the peace treaty. In the Second Battle of Manticore, Honor Harrington decisively defeats Filaretta, Solarian's 11th Fleet.
And at this point, we've got all three of the arcs basically tied together here. Yep. And
as I recall, it's reinforced here that from the Mason perspective or the Alignment's perspective, that they did not at all anticipate the possibility of an alliance like this forming.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. And in some ways, at this point, you could make an argument, it's at this point that the novel Shadow of Victory, the especially emphasizing on that victory part, you can argue that this is where Shadow of Victory actually starts. Mm. And I think this is probably around that chapter 36 point, JP.
Yeah, I didn't take any notes tying the chapters to the dates. I'd have to go back and look at the book, but I think you're right.
And I got to say something, Jim.
Yes.
Your summary here, this is my first time seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
I got to tell you, it kind of first of all, I'm going to wait and save it.
Okay. All right. So July 1922 PD, Lester Tourville is sent to join Mike's fleet.
Yay. Did Manticore you see that coming?
No, actually. Okay. Manticore officers are determined to help where it's needed with rebel movements so their reputation isn't tarnished. Manticoran naval elements are deployed around the sector to help where needed. Lester arrives with his fleet. While he is respected for his battle record, there are many hard feelings because of his successes. In other items, the Salarian League Assembly passes a resolution to investigate Beowulf for treason. Beowulf considers if they will remain in the League. Elements of the Manticoran 10th Fleet invade the Myers system and the Salarian League's Madras sector.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. August 19th.
See, now we're starting to see important elements that we haven't seen elsewhere. We're going to start seeing important elements happen.
Yeah. And I kind of suspected that. It was like there were a couple of times I was like, where did I read that before? But mm-hmm. I didn't. So, okay, August 1922 PD, the Mandarins on Earth are concerned that Beowulf will join Manticore in the war against the Salarian League. Situations around the sector begin to settle in some places, while violence continues in others. Manticoran naval elements begin to arrive around the sector to offer help where needed. Mike makes plans and heads for Mesa. Tarakov and Lester meet and exchange stories. Their meeting is tense, but amicable.
In fact, I would go a step further and say there's a friendship starting there.
Yeah, well, maybe. I felt a lot of tension reading that section.
Oh, I'm not saying that there wasn't the tension, but I think this is ultimately going to be the beginning of a friendship.
Yeah, well, okay. And encounters between Manticore and Salarians are starting to become more numerous. Okay. September 1922 PD, the alignment begins their mop-up of Mesa. Those that cannot move will be killed in a final flourish. And this next
section. It's odd. You think that when you first read that, it's a great comment, by the way, plot point. But when you read that, it's like, wait, the alignment is mopping up Mesa? The Grand Alliance isn't mopping up Mesa?
Yeah.
Yeah. Plugging leaks. Yeah. Evidence. Yeah.
So, and now this next part was a definite bright spot for me, at least. Scotty Tremaine's ship and small fleet approach Vaclavek, a group of Solarian ships, believing they now have weapons superior to Manticore, enter the system to restore the government. They learn they are flanked by more ships and attempt to run. Tremaine does some risky but brilliant moves to make the Solarians stand down, but they refuse. After a brief cat-and-mouse game, Tremaine prevails.
And I did like that part.
Yep. And Lester arrives and joins Mike's fleet to head for Mesa. Okay. Mm-hmm. And finally, to finish this up, and it went a lot faster than I thought it was going to, October 1922 PD, as Mike and Lester approach Mesa, it isn't long before Albrecht unleashes his final flourish, which consists of a chain of nuclear explosions killing an estimated 6 million people,
including himself and his wife.
Mm-hmm. And Mike figures the Manticorans will be blamed.
In fact, that was Albrecht timed it just for that purpose.
Yeah.
By the way, well, I went back and looked real quick in the book, and chapter 36 falls between February and April of 1922. So, yeah, February, March timeframe, mm-hmm. somewhere in there is where
yep, the story that was around
makes the big change. Yep. So you were right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that's the summary. Turn it over to Raul because we're going to talk about some characters.
That's a yep. good summary, by the way.
It's a very good. And you know, this is why this goes along with what I was saying. When you look at that summary you give, it should work.
Ah.
Yeah.
It should work.
Yeah. I'm glad for that because I couldn't think of any other way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Without making it way overly detailed and
yep,
but at any rate,
and I got to thank you to begin with for the change in format, because there's no possible way to consider the massive characters in this book. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to kind of stick to just some of the primary ones, and that's not going to include the characters in Vlachovec or Chertobor or Seraphim, the other, where all of those events get followed up on.
Yeah.
Obviously, we've got Michelle Henke. We've got Ivers and Shanae Tarakoff, and I'm going to not discuss Shanae here because I'm going to be talking, I'll talk a little bit about her and my favorite plot points, and I think she's probably going to end up being my quote. I've got my quotes. I didn't put them in our notes because I still haven't decided which one I'm going to use. Ginger Lewis. Who would have guessed that she was a Monty Python and the Holy Grail fan?
High point of the book.
One of them. Yep, that one did make me laugh.
I love that, yeah. Lester Tourville, new BFF with Avers, first of all, and I still think she's the... I still think he's the final in-game romantic interest for Michelle. And think about this. Think about this if you're into fan shipping, if you really wanted to put a true seal on the relationship between Manticore and Haven, that's the relationship that would do it.
Yeah.
And you notice they kept talking, Michelle kept talking about her image as a cowboy in the book. Yeah. Which is exactly what Lester was. No, it's like they truly are kindred spirits. So it's like, sorry, I know it's just my own little fantasy world. So
yeah,
and by the way, because it came up earlier, Lester and Ivars, mm-hmm. there's no reason these guys can't become friends.
No, I mean the tension is expected. There would be something wrong if there wasn't.
Well,
but their determination to go beyond that.
It's going to take time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yep. Because as we know, and as we've discussed on numerous occasions, the I was just following orders thing doesn't work. And, you know, there were a heck of a lot of deaths on both sides. Lester seems to be taking it, or he is trying to show he's not taking it as personally as Tarakoff.
Mm-hmm. Well, keep in mind, he's got that relationship with Honor as well to help him along.
Yeah. Well, we read in one of the books in the past, I can't remember which one, mm-hmm. how Lester felt about watching all that death and destruction going on, and it affected him deeply. It does, I would imagine, any commander.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other thing to look at it is, never mind.
Okay,
I'm worn out and my brain's just not freaking working.
yeah, so we got Lester and Scotty.
Yep. Or Damien Harahap. A lot of the story is built around developing this character, I gotta be careful because I don't want to spoil stuff in future books. At the end of the day, he kind of takes a sympathetic and a bit of a positive turn, to be honest. And that's, frankly, it's too easy to lose that if you've been trapped in that first part of the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, the big mistake that he makes is he gets involved personally.
Well, yeah. And he, I'll tell you what, the guy knows how to sell.
He knows how to sell. Mm-hmm. But he gets involved in things personally, and at the end of the day, he has to make a real choice.
Yeah.
And he actually ends up making the right choice in spite of the personal price that he's going to have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't considered what that real price might ultimately be, because think about, he works for the alignment. What has typically happened with people who work for the alignment who decide, I don't want to work for the alignment?
They disappear.
You know, or worse. So you know that's got a weigh on him.
Yeah.
Get taken to the train station.
Yep. Admiral Tamaguchi, I have to bring him up from the Tremaine from the Tremaine battle with Frontier Fleet. Well, he's Frontier Fleet, not Battle Fleet. So that's an important factor to keep in mind because yeah. It's like, okay, not all Solly Fleet commanders, not all Solarian Fleet commanders are actually incompetent. Scotty had to beat him. He had to outthink him. It wasn't just a blowaway like it has been in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Albrecht Detweiler finally gets his, except it was still on his terms. And frankly, overall, the whole bit, that just kind of creeps you out.
You know, with the battles that we see Scotty Tremaine involved in this book,
mm-hmm.
There were two cool things about that. One is he's a guy that we are predisposed to like, and so it'd be kind of easy to have some cool space battles going down and yeah, go Scotty and all that. But and I assume this was a part of the intent with David, using Scotty, who's a known good guy. And that'll just mean we like the character, but like he has all the competence that he ought to have. And he has to work, like you mentioned, Raul, is that actually help paint a good picture for why we ought to appreciate Tamaguchi.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's not just another idiot out there
right.
in the Frontier Fleet. This guy is different. And you could tell a story that just suggests he's different, or you put him up against somebody like Scotty Tremaine,
who's basically one of Honor's proteges.
Right. And all of a sudden you go, hey, I know it's not just because I'm in the story, I'm told Tamaguchi is a different animal. It's because we watched him go at it with Scotty.
Mm-hmm.
And Scotty had to work, which I think is what you said, right?
Exactly.
Like, mm-hmm. So that was a really awesome way to paint a picture of Admiral Tamaguchi for us as the readers. And again, you know, Jim and I have read this far, right? We don't know what's going to come, if there's more with this guy or whatnot, but that was an awesome way to present Tamaguchi to us in what felt like a really cool setup for things to come, you know, that kind of.
You know, the other thing that I like to think about on this is this particular battle. One of the things that was nice about that battle with Tamaguchi and Scotty is it really brought back a feel for some of the early novel fights.
Yep, it did.
It really had that sense where it's like, and I get where it had grown, but I missed the small squadron, the small fleet action, and it was nice to get that touch back to that through Scotty. Places, things, organizations, the Talbot cluster, much of the story in particular, Vlashevik, Chotobar, Seraphim, Mobius, places that are new, places that we've been familiar with, places that need Eastern European lexicons mixed in with some Gaelic.
Yeah. You know, putting aside the difficulty of the first half of the book, this barrage of locations is what needed to be there to paint the picture of how widespread all of this
mm-hmm.
pot stirring was. That was the attempt to derail Manticore and paint them in a bad light. So that was, you know, whether we're looking at Polish names or Czech names or English names, the scale of this manipulation was painted pretty well.
Yeah. And I think there was another aspect to this as well. And I think I believe I had hinted to this in earlier novels, especially when you get Vlachevek and Chotobar, you're talking Eastern European revolutions and Eastern European revolutionary movements. And then when you're looking at Seraphim, Mobius, and what we've seen so far in the Shadows novels, in the Saganami novels, we've been seeing mostly Western European revolutionary aspects. So there's a especially when you start looking at the oligarchical and some of the, just, you know, the oligarchical, I mean, you can really see the Russian versus the West in how the revolutions take place and how the power structures are set up. So I think part of this, what part of the intent was to give that kind of a contrast between the Eastern and Western European movements, revolutionary movements.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll let you talk about that when you get into your themes, JP.
Okay.
If you even go in that direction.
Yeah, I'll probably give you a springboard to come back to it, but I don't.
Okay.
I'll just tell you, I'm not going to go into depth about Eastern versus Western European insurgencies and revolutions, but I do, but I stopped short of that. I'll put it that way. You'll see.
Well, then I won't have, then I was going to say, I just covered that final step of it there. And that means you're going to have everything up to Mesa. We've got the, in addition to Final Flourish, we've got the Battle of Mesa, Mike to the Rescue, and okay, it turns out Mesa was a decoy all along for Darius, which is the real malign alignment.
Yeah.
And the term that you're going to start seeing used is the benign alignment of the malign alignment. The benign alignment and the malign alignment. Say that combo three times fast.
No, thank you.
I suspect this is why there's so much discussion about this whole structure being an onion rather than trying to regularly work through those tongue hangers.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we're getting set up for is like, okay, what is the role? Something is definitely being set up where Zach and Gail are concerned on Darius now. So where is that going to go, and what is that? Who's going to be? What is that role going to be? And I think this might be something that David is setting up for his next for his proteges in the storytelling that he's been grooming. I suspect they'll be the ones that carry out that. At least that's what I suspect that's what he's been training them for. And we'll let David answer that question for us at some point.
Yeah. And by the way, before we jump into themes, two things that I didn't really know where to say this. Something I thought to bring up at the end, but I'm going to say it here. There is, and I'll speak for myself, and then you guys can say me too or whatever. Two things here. One is the issues that I had with the first half of the book have not in any way soiled the overall story that's going on in the Honorverse and the story that unfolded in the first three books of this arc. So it's exciting to think that there could be more coming. I just hope it's not like the first half of this book, because I do appreciate some of the stage setting that we've already talked about, these potential friendships, the emergence of Darius and its role in all of this. Like this is all really cool stuff. So no worries there. If I didn't fall off the wagon, I'm still on. the issues are focused on a particular set of issues, and I pretty much said what those were. The other is, because I said too much Polish, I have no issue with the Polish language or the history, or the history that is used to create a not historic story, or like no issue at all. It was a volume. And Jim, you said something that was resonated with me. It was a volume of the language that I don't speak and that I'm not super familiar with that led me to the point that every organization name was the same as every other organization name. Like, I lost the appreciation to track because it's such a different language than what I've been exposed to.
And it wasn't just that it was Polish. You had that with the Polish, and you had that with the Czech.
Yes. But, and I brought up Polish because I said too much Polish. I didn't say too much Czech. And, so hopefully if anyone's listening that is Polish or speaks Polish, I am admitting my own limitation in that regard. But it's feedback as a first time reader of these books is like, you know, I have managed the presentation of things that are favoring or even using other languages, because once something was introduced, I feel like the thing that was described with a cool foreign, speaking as an American hero, a cool foreign name, but I wouldn't necessarily be able to associate that that was the secret ministry of secrets that after it's introduced and maybe only used a few times, it becomes the secret ministry of secrets. And I don't have to go, wait, what was that one again? But for whatever reason in this book, and it could 100% be me, and I'm, like I said, I'm open to for somebody to say you missed the obvious or what have you, that that was my beef with this. So there's that. Too much Polish for me, but I'm not criticizing that we got and a I think really cool I think Eastern European storyline here.
I think everyone actually understands that and appreciates that because it, like I said, Dave's own comment was mixing up, having both made it too much. Might have been too, so.
Yeah. So anyway, I get that in there now so I don't forget to say it later.
And go ahead and keep talking because this is the segue into themes.
Oh, okay. So the obvious one here is revolution and or insurgency or that kind of thing. And then I'm going to keep rolling and some of this is going to tie back to those themes. And it's the same stuff you have already mentioned, or it's going to color some of the stuff you already mentioned, Raul, about we're seeing kind of Eastern European themed behavior here as opposed to Western European. More on that, more to discuss on that. So revolution or insurgency, yes. Diplomatic manipulation, you can call it foreign policy. That's all over the place in this book. And it's stuff that has appeared in the past parts of the Honorverse story. By the way, the military calls this shaping. The concept is shaping or shaping the enemy or shaping the battlefield if you want to get a little less strategic with it. And I'll just tell you that this, when one side of a fight is trying to manipulate the other in this way, and there's a military component to it, we refer to it as shaping. If somebody said, what's the target of shaping? It's the enemy commander's mind. So it's manipulation, but that's happening all over the place in here. And it's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. A tip of the hat to the alignment, to send out fake agents and diplomats and into the field pretending to be representatives of Manticore, go out there making all these promises to assist them in their rebellion or their revolution or their insurgency or whatever you want to call it. And poor old Manticore had no idea that these evil seeds were being planted. And that made for me a highlight in the story that because it was a real problem. In the story, this was a real problem that Manticore has to deal with.
Yeah, it was basically false flag operations.
Yeah. And I really appreciate how David sets this up, not just to create a dilemma where Manticore's got to go, we didn't make you that promise, or what do we do about it, was that it made it very easy for the manipulated enemies of Manticore to go, see, they are as expansionist as we always thought they were, these little evil, imperialists. Well, that wasn't the intent at all with Manticore, and it really helped build out all the stuff that was happening on a quote-unquote local level in single star systems. And here you go, man, the alignment. So good on them. I hate them, but but they did a cool thing to cause harm. So it's not a cool thing, but you know what I mean. And it's neat that Manticore doesn't show up and just go like, yeah, that wasn't us, and walk away and try to deal with the damage that may or may not cause. They don't fix every situation either.
Mm-mm,
no,
they do fix that. I mean, Michelle's got what they find out about it. Michelle's approach is, we're going to step in and intervene.
Right. We'll make good on the promise, even though we didn't make that promise.
But not every case are they able to do that.
No. Right. Right. And that's what foments this instability and war. But cool stuff. Cool part of the, I said, I had a beef with part of the book, but the rest was good. And my only comment in that, all this diplomatic manipulation that's going on is, hey, alignment, just don't get caught. Because, okay, not really a theme, but I wanted to call this out because I had not seen this word for like decades. cool use of the term revanchism, and it's just not a word that anybody uses anymore, but it used to find it all over in, you know, articles and journals and books and all that when it came to international relations. And even in history books, it was used, and it's just not a common word now. But so awesome. It just made me smile that that word worked its way in here. For those that don't know what that word means, or, you know, either because you didn't take the time to look it up, again, assuming you didn't know it, or you thought, I'll get back to that. What the heck does that mean? Or maybe you gleaned it out of the context. But that word is rooted in the word revenge. And in the past, most often when it's used in the context of military, because this is military science fiction, it's used to talk about setting policy to regain territory that's lost in combat. And the alignment hopes this happens as they discuss what they hope to see if the Solarian League loses territory to Manticore. And then creates a continuing tension now between those two parties. So, and possibly future fighting, you know, the continuance of fighting if one is trying to sue the other side for getting land back that they lost in the war.
So another spot where David was prophetic.
Yeah. Yes. Yep. So there you have that. Again, not a theme, but I needed to call that out because it kind of tied into this. Economics, another thing that's strong in this book. It doesn't run throughout the whole book bluntly, but it's when it shows up, it's big. And specifically, it's economic warfare in some cases. And then specifically, also the economic impact on war, which has become a regular theme in these books. You can only fight a war that you can afford to pay for, and you go to war with the military that you have bought. And we're watching that kind of cook here as Manticore struggles with putting out the dozens of fires that got lit in an attempt to bring them down. Second to last, slavery, and specifically genetic slavery. Shocker that we see that kind of surface a little bit in here. It gets discussed, I get. It adds a little bit more color or confirms some things we might have suspected were going on with the alignment. And the last one is this overarching thing. I just call it freedom. And my quote will address this, but what people who crave freedom are eventually willing to do to shed themselves of oppression. That foreshadows my quote. So now, Raoul, do you or Jim, do you want to go back and color in more on insurgency or revolution?
I think between what I've said and what you added in as far as context, really, okay. I think it's pretty thorough.
Yeah.
And folks that aren't familiar,
I agree.
Like on some level, revolution is revolution. Couple it to my last theme, freedom, but because of culture and a bunch of other dynamics, even geography, the way that those revolutions unfold, there is a difference between what Eastern European revolutions look like and what Western look like. And that's about all you need to know. But this book gives you a taste of that. If you're into that stuff, you know, then you're going to do what David does and what I do. And, you know, even
studying,
certainly, yeah, you're going to end up picking up history books and trying to find the ones that aren't so freaking geeky about a particular thing that an overarching point is lost. There's a lot written on what these Eastern European countries have gone through historically. And but I'm basically saying, don't waste your time reading that stuff unless you go, I have an interest in this. And then it's there, and it's interesting for folks who find it interesting how those struggles look very different than Western Europe.
And this book does reflect those differences very well.
It does. It does. So, yeah. So those are the themes. And it seems like we're moving in a good way, like we're moving pretty quick here. But we are up to really, Raoul, talking about favorite
plot points.
Plot points. Yeah.
You know, I'm going to open this by saying it's like you. I'm going to point out at this point what I was going to say about Jim. I was originally going to save this for takeaways, but with your outline and with the way this discussion has shaped, and it's done it organically, I've really made it an effort not to try and steer anything in one direction or the other. Your outline really kind of matches up with how I've reread the book when I've done my rereads. And I've noticed what both of you have tended to gravitate towards organically with really hitting the strengths where the strong points are in the book. And I'll say more about that I'll say more about that when we get to my ratings. But if I'm seeming more sympathetic to the book than you guys, it's because of the rereading and how what you guys have talked about has actually reflected the context in which I've reread. And like I said, when you look at Jim's outline of the plot of the story on paper, it's, you know, in that outline format, it's a different, it looks different than how it read, at least for the first half of the book, for the first half. So favorite plot points, Jim, I'm going to go ahead and pass that to you first.
Okay, fair enough. So in my opening remarks, I said there were some bright spots in this book. One of those was my favorite plot point of the whole book when Mike and Lester arrive at Mesa. It just felt more like what I was used to reading all these books. How about you, JP?
Yes. First for me was, and I mentioned earlier, I was happy to see Ginger getting command. Ginger's speech after assuming command was gold, and that was in chapter 38 for folks that want to go back and look at it. It was gold, and frankly, she's gold as a character. Well, I guess she's technically Ginger.
She is redheaded, right?
Making a color joke here, but I'm going to assume she's a redhead, but that doesn't mean that.
I thought she was actually.
I don't know that she is, but she's gold. She gets the gold vote. And then second to that, that speech, which is not in my quotes because it's long for one. And like I said, go want to read it, go to 38. It's there. But the other was that this dynamic duo, we keep talking about all three of us, right? Lester and Mike. Holy cow. That part of the story just had me smiling. And I don't think it was just because I had such a bad experience in the first half of the book. It's because it was really good. Once they started to dance, I'll put dance in quotes, right? What a dance that is. So more please, you know, if there's a way.
I can't think of a more dangerous combination of two flag officers that I could possibly imagine.
Yeah. And I said once they started to dance, because there's real caution between them. But wow. So, yeah. So, Raul, save the best for last. Go, sir.
Well, chapter 76, Lester and Michelle. The extent to which those two are kindred spirits is like, damn. And like I said earlier, those two would be a perfect pairing for the combination of those two star nations.
Yes.
Favorite plot point, to borrow your word, JP, Shanae Tarakov. Anywhere she shows up in this story is gold. Her conversation with Ginger just really hits in the feels. It's just fantastic. And then there's her headbutt with Admiral Kamala. The poor guy didn't know what he was running into.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if I forgot things I should remember about her or if it was really a lot of new stuff here, but I wasn't sure.
This was all new stuff with her.
Good. Because I would have felt silly. I didn't know what I was supposed to think of her.
Was her original interaction with Tarakov.
Yep.
I think maybe the party where Ginger had first met her. And, oh, gee, she's going to head out to the Verge. She's going to head out to the Talbot Cluster. To be with her husband, and that was pretty much all we had.
And part of that,
this book made me think she's
a problem and not in a good way. But I quickly grew very fond of this character,
and she's a force of nature.
Yeah. Yep.
Third plot point, and this is mostly because I've read the rest of the book, but you should have been able to catch the foreshadowings. Is Damien's development of a conscience and his capture?
Yeah.
Now, the real question is, at this point, are they going to be able to keep him alive long enough to be of any value?
Yeah.
And from there, Jim, I think we've been moving pretty good here. I think we're ready for quotes from you, sir.
All right. So, my favorite quote. This comes from a brief moment in the book that made me laugh out loud. Coming up on the mark, ma'am, Lieutenant Commander Nakhimov announced. Now notice that name. Nakhimov. Okay. Lieutenant Commander Nakhimov announced, and Ginger Lewis looked up from her smaller maneuvering plot, where she'd been reviewing Scotty Tremaine's proposed movements, and turned her command chair back towards the main display. "Run away, run away," she muttered under her breath. It was one of her favorite lines from one of the incredible ancient movies to which Duchess Harrington had introduced her and much of the rest of the HMS Wayfarer's crew on her very first cruise. Fortunately, however, none of her bridge crew heard her. Somehow she doubted it would have comported well with the gravitas of a proper CO. Now, what ancient movie do you rhetorically suppose Ginger would be referring to?
I have
one,
no,
two,
I,
five.
Yeah. All right.
What, no one here is going to yell out, "No, three, my lord."
Because once we start down this path, we'll never get
forever
away from
will it.
It
consume your destiny.
Yes. Yeah. So we're
and
going.
Jim, you're
going
to have to say the line you haven't had to say in a long time.
Yeah, this is not the Monty Python and the Holy Grail podcast. This is the Honorverse today. And I'm going to hand it over to JP.
He's right. Trying to keep me quiet.
So this quote is a conversation between Hieronym Mazur and Thomas Sponder. Ties back to the concept of freedom. A little out of context, but nobody will not see where this is going. So here's the quote. "Your new friend, Admiral Tamaguchi, probably won't thank you a lot for handing him a planet that needs to be completely rebuilt before it starts pouring any credits into OFS's pockets." "You wouldn't dare," Mazur sneered. "And even if you would, those proles down there with you wouldn't. They may be stupid, but they're smart enough to realize they'd be blowing up their own livelihoods right along with it." "That's the point you've never understood, Hieronym," Sponsor told him quietly. "It's not their livelihoods. It never has been. Because of people like you. People who systematically make sure they'll never have a chance to be more than the proles you keep calling them. People who think all proles care about is licking the hand of someone who treats them like cattle. Not human beings who know their lives could be better. People who want to have a voice in how their world's governed, who want their children's lives to be better than theirs, not snuffed out by some stupid effing," I did the family edit there, "oligarcha who gets away with mass murder just because she's your cousin. Those people you have so much contempt for are angry, and they understood the risks when they decided to support me."
Yep.
Yep.
That freedom, you know, then ties back to all these themes, too, that we've seen when Haven was the People's Republic of Haven. Like, this issue has been a thing through the entire Honorverse. And here's another kind of cool instance where it bubbles to the top.
Yeah. But you know something, JP, I've been thinking for the last few minutes as you read that. How many oppressive governments where people aren't necessarily looking for freedom, but they are more looking for a less harsh type of government than what they normally have.
Yeah. I don't know that there's like a technical answer to that, because to me, if they're grasping for that, something just less harsh, that still looks like freedom to them. They may not have the ability to, you know, quote unquote, dream bigger than what they're shooting for.
Right.
Or maybe they can, but they don't know how they're going to achieve it. So they go for as much as they think they can pull off. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure. And there are people, I mean, you look at our own history, our own American history, you know, it's easy to think that everybody consensed and agreed we were going to go to war with England for freedom. And if we die doing it, then that's so be it. That was not supported by a significant part of the population.
Mm-hmm.
Who, by the way, complained about some of the things that fueled the Revolutionary War.
Yeah.
The demand a quarter soldiers in your house, private property, or the taxes that were being levied without representation or whatever. But you say, well, then let's rebel. And they're like, what? No, you know, I don't like it, but I'm not going to fight against the crown. So there are people that don't want it, but want something better. There are people that want it, but aren't willing to risk what the cost could be. And there's people that are ready to go.
Yeah.
I'll fight to the death for this. And you can broaden out from our own little history and see all of those same kinds of things cooking inside any place that's experiencing a revolution of sorts like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know if we could like look and say, well, in this country, I'd put it in this box, and in this other country, I'd put it in another box. There's a whole layer of detail too, where revolutions or apparent revolutions begin, but really it's there's no truth behind it, or there might be a few poor people that believe it, but those are ways that insurgents use to strike at the existing government so that they can then insert themselves to be, in the end, even more despotic. So, but the poor people get caught up in it, think they might be getting something good based on promises that weren't even genuine.
Yeah.
And they reach for a vapor.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, that's a cool thing to think about, or interesting thing to think about, is people that may just want something better, but I put those people in the category that I'm not going to fight about it, but I really wish I got something better than what I have.
Yeah.
Or I'll fight, but only a little bit. I'm not going to go to jail for this. Certainly not going to die for it, but they'll help a little, you know. I'll print leaflets or something. Certainly I won't get blamed for that, or, you know. Raul?
Yeah. You were saying, it's like the people who will only go and vote on election day and forget about it the rest of the time.
Yeah. And that may be totally okay with them.
Mm-hmm.
But looking into why.
Yep.
You know, or they could look at somebody who's more active and would ask the same question. It's just the opposite. So, you know, they're looking at the other side of the coin and asking the very same question. Why is that person so fanatical? So, yeah. But kudos to David, man. This is the stuff he's making us think about.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Now you have to make a choice, good sir, because
I've got two quotes and they're both longish. One of them was when Indiana hands Harahap over to Zavala. Great bit of story there. But that's not going to be the one that I have to use. At the end of the day, and it's going to be a long one, so Jimmy, I'm sorry if you have to edit me to make it work.
I'm used to it.
That's what blooper reels are for.
Yeah, gee. This is when Shanae is going down to Snotty Row to make it out to the Talbot Cluster with Ginger. Basically, almost as a stowaway, to be honest. But anyway, you're probably right about that. Ginger shook her head, gazing down into her whiskey glass. I think he tries to hide it sometimes, but he always seems to be able to spot anyone under his command who's in trouble. If you haven't figured it out yet, they're talking about Ivers. Don't get me wrong. Anston Fitzgerald stayed on top of everything that happened to any of the Kitty's people. But it just always seemed that whenever I looked up, the Commodore was always, I don't know, he was always there whenever anyone needed him. That's Ivers Wason, they said. And there's probably another reason it seemed that way to you, dear. Ginger's eyes snapped up from her glass, meeting Shanae's across the table, and her mouth opened, but Shanae held up her hand before she could speak. Ginger, she said gently, I don't for one instant believe that anything remotely improper ever happened between you and Ivers. One of the very few immutable certainties of this universe is my husband's fidelity. But ever since his return to active service, he's had an even greater tendency to mentor, let's say, promising young officers, especially promising young female officers. Ginger had closed her mouth again, but her eyes were still distressed, and Shanae shook her head. I've known Ivers Terikoff for the next best thing to 50 T-years, and because of that, I know he'd never allow favoritism to color his actions or his decisions. But I come from a Navy family myself, she said. with Ginger Reflected, massive understatement. I remember her family was a very significant naval family. And I also know he understands a senior officer's responsibility to groom, train, and support promising junior officers. He'd do that for anyone he thought was good at her or his job, as you are. But there's a reason he's especially supportive of his female junior officers, a reason which applies rather strongly in your own case, I suspect. A reason, Ginger repeated when the older woman paused. Yes, Shanae's eyes softened. You look a great deal like me, Ginger, but you look even more like Anastasia. And if you remember, she looks almost identical to Anastasia. But you look even more like Anastasia. Anastasia? Our daughter, Shanae said quietly, and Ginger stiffened. Nastenka was never interested in the Navy, unnatural child that she was, Shanae continued with a wistful smile. She was interested in planets, and she begged, pleaded, and pestered until she got her way. She was a little bit too much like both parents in that respect, I think. By the time Ava's return to active service, after the Battle of Hancock, she was accepted into the Sphinx Forestry Service's intern program. I never saw her happier in her life, and then about a year later, she fell from a crown oak during a tree cat rescue mission, and her countergraph failed to activate. Ginger inhaled sharply, and Shanae nodded. She suffered catastrophic brain trauma, she said in a steady voice. The SFS airlifted her out immediately, but she was gone by the time they reached the trauma unit. If she'd lived, she'd be about a year younger than you are now. Ginger shook her head, and Shanae reached across the table to lay one hand on her forearm. Ginger, Avers would have recognized the quality which makes you the officer you are, even if you'd been male 2 meters tall and covered with hair. And I'm not telling you he values you more because you remind him of Nastenka. I'm simply saying he sees an echo of her in every promising young woman he meets, and that because you look so much like her, he probably sees that echo even more strongly in your case. And one of the reasons I'm telling you this is that I do too. Neither of us think of you as a replacement for our daughter, and both of us value you for who you are. But I think it's right for you to know about her, and perhaps it'll help you understand why I'm perfectly content down in Snotty Row with young Paula. She's a Queen's officer, not a child, but she's also a young woman who's lost her entire family. If she needs a non-Navy shoulder to cry on, just a bit, I have one that's perfectly serviceable.
Yeah, great quote.
Sorry it was long, folks, but you need to understand Sinead Herikoff.
That wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
As far as length.
It's one of those that as you... In the whole context of that part of the story, it just really hits you.
Yeah.
And go ahead, Jim.
Well, I was going to say, oftentimes it is really difficult to figure out where to cut a quote.
That's why I had to do the whole thing.
Because some of the quotes go on for pages. Some of the best ones, you know.
Yep. This was, well, all told, probably close to 2 pages, but.
I think just as important as what that tells us about her, that added some great info on her husband. Like, we got to hear that explanation, yeah. I think, for the first time. And it's like, because I never thought there was any ill intent on his part in the way he was mentoring these officers, these junior officers. I just didn't know why it seemed like there were certain passions in there. And here we get it. It's like, yep. Wow, what a story. It makes his wife a really cool character to us, but it paints him a little better yet in terms of what we knew about him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
Jim, we're at the point of wrapping here, so I'm going to pass it back to you.
So, closing thoughts. As I said before.
We're not on a gas giant.
Okay. As I said before, this was a complete slog fest with a few bright spots. I'd considered not finishing this book numerous times during my month-long struggle to get through it. It was too long and loaded with conversations that meant nothing to me between the characters I could not care less about. There were far too many unpronounceable names and too much inaction, which overshadowed those brief moments of action. I saw a suggestion that this book might be read at the same time as Shadow of Freedom. Personally, I don't think one book should depend on another, to be clear. Okay. Having to read a story that way would make the whole exercise a little too close to a research project for my taste, and I'm not going for another degree. If it is important to the story, put it in the book. Outside of the plot points I mentioned earlier, the saga wasn't advanced by this book in my mind in any way, and I would have been happy just not reading this. JP?
All right. Well, in spite of the good things in the novel, I'm going to finish with what I said at the front. I didn't like it. It's the only book by David that I have not liked. And it was because of that, it was almost dizzying because everything else that we've read has been so incredible. I still don't know what to make of it. If I ever had to read it again, I'd start at chapter 36. I can't foresee me ever going back to the first half of that book. I'm just not going to give it the time. I'm a little saddened that this was how what I think was an otherwise great story arc ended. But the good news is,
I don't think the Saganami's line has completely ended at this point. So just keep that.
Yeah. And we've danced around with that. It's where we are so far. The good news is that there are more Honorverse novels still to come, and history says that they're going to be awesome. So I am not discouraged.
Oh yeah.
I am ready for more. And if more emerges in this story arc, that's cool too, because I'm going to just assume this was a weird exception to what I would characterize as.
This is one out of 40 books.
Yeah. So not discouraged, and I hope no one else is.
Don't tell anybody. But I've read the next book already, and
Leaker.
It'll be awesome.
So Raul, bring us home.
Okay. Honestly, like I said, I'm not sure why the book was structured as a novel. If it were put together as several short stories plus the novella, it would have worked much, much better, I think. Oh, hello, Obi-Wan. I'll let you out in a minute. It would have worked much, much better, I think. What has gotten me to do the first reread was actually, like you said, JP, was the second half, which to a large degree, the Michelle and whole 10th Fleet action, really not just Michelle, but the whole 10th, could have been that novella or just a short, even more than a novella, a short novel.
Yeah.
And in that second reading, knowing what was in that first half, actually kind of is going to kind of make me a little more charitable in my rating on those rereads. I wasn't trying to figure out who, what, where, and I just got past those plot elements for themselves. In one way, I kind of just had a mental divorce from those parts, and that made it actually not difficult to get through. And it let me focus on the really good parts. In particular, like I said, the second half of the novel was just fine and quite good in a lot of points. So, and there were some of the stuff that happened with Mesa, with Hera Hap's development, and as we know from Jim's cheating, you're talking about one of the call books, so it was one of the prequels. Yeah. Oh, gosh. Like I said, I like the second half just fine. In a way, that's kind of, and this is why I do really wish it had been done more in that short story in a novella format, because there's a lot of modern day relevance to that first part of the book. And it's going to be lost, I think, a lot in the reading, especially a first reading. But believe it or not, it's the rereads that one of the things that kind of made me more charitable. And I'll explain that it makes my scoring a little bit odd. And I'll get to that because basically I have to rate this book two times, but they're going to be the same scores. So,
well, let's talk about ratings.
Let's talk about the ratings in that case then. Jim, I'm going to give you the first shot at it.
Okay. I went back and I looked at the ratings I've had for all these books, and I came up with something. It's like 4.7 something. So this one I gave 2.5 Damien Harpap aliases. That guy had more names.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
And you know what it said in the book? It said that his aliases all meant the same thing. Firebrand. Mm-hmm.
Of some sort. Yep.
Yeah. How about you, JP?
I gave it 2 Mason alignment political maneuvers. Raul, let's hear this.
I've got 2 ratings, actually, times 2. For the first half, I would join you guys giving it a 2. For the second half of the book, after chapter 36, I would be leaning more toward a solid 4. That's the first rating, which comes down to, well, you could do the math. The other rating is based on looking at it from the first time I read it. Based on the first time I read the book, I would have given it a 2, which is flat on consistent with what you guys have rated it. On the rereads and having it in the context with the entire series and reading it in an approach that kind of reflects Jim's outline, where I'm focusing on, where I'm not getting bogged down, not letting myself get bogged down at all in the Polish or the Czech aspects of it, I become much more charitable and I'm closer to a 4. Either way, it averages out to 3 Houdini strikes.
All right.
So,
and how does that work out?
Somebody with all their fingers and toes. What does that give us with for an overall?
Well, overall, we rated this a 2.5, and on Goodreads, it came through with a 3.76 with 2,965 ratings, and Amazon came in at a 3.9 with 3,859 ratings.
So some serious dips there too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're notably below both of those, but it looks like the fans reading this didn't like it as much as a lot of the other stuff that's been read.
No. So do we have any remarks from listeners at all or shout outs to make?
Yes. I've got a whole stack of actual comments that have collected over time. So, unfortunately, I did not get to dip into the Facebook side. I don't know if you got anything there from there or not.
There's not really been anything lately.
Well, we've been talking more about the prequel books, and I've noticed our comments tend to dip down on those. But feedback from Baz, the short version of it, is he's wanting to know what we're going to follow up the Honorverse books with. And he's not the only one who's asked about what are we going to do after Honor Harrington.
And we'll be happy to share that when the time is right.
As soon as we know ourselves.
the important takeaway of their comments, Baz, is that okay, it doesn't sound like we're planning to just simply go away into the sunset after this is done.
No, we enjoy this fellowship way too much.
Very much so.
And as I always say, listeners, if you have a suggestion of what you would like us to do, write it on a $50 bill, send it to my address, and
we're open to inputs,
and we'll put it in a hat and see what we draw out.
Or you can just email it to me.
I like my idea better.
I was about to follow that up with it, and I'll give you my PayPal information so you can send that 50 to me electronically. All righty. Another email that we got from Robert. This is a new listener, in fact. Episode 1 review. Just starting to listen to the podcast from the very beginning after seeing it mentioned on Reddit. I'm sure much of my thoughts have already been touched by you or other commenters. All the same, thank you for what you do. Great format. Good viewpoint from 2 sets of fresh eyes, Jim and JP. While Raul's long experience with the franchise offers hints of more to come, Wish you'd spoke more on the unconventional modifications, gravlances and energy torpedoes, strong but incredibly short range, made to the Fearless by Hemphill and her change is always good faction of the Navy design, especially contrasting it with more standard loadouts, missiles and lasers. This configuration for the Fearless is a big reason why the Q-ships were so troublesome to bring down. Though it would probably be best addressed in a general introduction to the franchise, giving a physical description of the Kingdom of Manticore. This would offer a better understanding of why the Republic of Haven was trying to take over such an out-of-the-way system like Basilisk. Side note, Jimenez referred to them as the People's Republic, not just Jim. Not just yet, Jim. Oh, that should have been Jim has referred to them as People's Republic, not just yet. I realize you're likely trying not to get too detailed since you want readers to discover things for themselves, which is true.
Yeah, including two readers that are in this
podcast. It's likely just a matter of taste and book talk. Shout out to the young lady voicing the intro outro. I believe you said in episode 0 it was your wife. Yep, that's Anthea. From the very start, I thought her voice and speech mannerisms seemed perfect for a podcast about Honor Harrington. Looking forward to episode 2, more than on Basilisk Station, the Honor of the Queen really sold me on the series. First of all, yeah, you're going to find a lot more discussion on Q-ships and on the technologies. Keep in mind, if you've read the series already, there's some treatises and some appendices and a lot of that kind of discussion in that is going to come up ahead. And likewise with the physical description of the Kingdom of Manticore, that is particularly something we thought it's like, we're going to let that unfold organically and it will. Any thoughts or additions for you two?
No.
Nope.
All right. And I'm going to close it off. My wife is a voiceover artist. Her rates are reasonable. So if you got any work for her, feel free to send them in. Shameless plug.
Fair enough.
He mentioned Reddit. So from Reddit, St. J. Magistra comments that listening to the most recent episode, I was a bit confused by the end comments. Was it recorded before the David Weber, Jane Linscold interview, but released afterwards? It was. And yeah, we recorded. This was he's talking about Shadow of Freedom. And yeah, we recorded the interview right after we recorded Shadow of Freedom. When we got the interviews, we tried to time the release. When we get the interviews, we tried to time it as soon as possible. But we also take into account where some of the timing is in the series. And in this case, we also took into account the electronic availability, the early release availability of Friends Indeed. Yeah. Jim and JP hadn't read that book yet, but I had, and there were some non-spoiler questions on it. So we decided it was better to get the episode out ASAP rather than holding on to it because of the Friends Indeed comments, we wanted those out available sooner rather than later. Let's see. Click. This one is basically a question for David. Kudzu? Speaking as a Southerner, this was from Crimson Dawn 236, and I promised to ask this to David. So, David, this one's for you. As a Southerner, I have to say the most unbelievable immersion-breaking thing in this beloved series is Kudzu. Are you telling me that Austin Grayson looked at all the plants on Earth and went, see that plant over there? Yeah, that's the one we're literally eating. Yeah, that's the one that's literally eating the South. I want that one on my new home. I can see another Earth plant growing out of control on another planet the way Kudzu does, but Kudzu? What do they expect? Yeah, David, you're from the South yourself. Explain Kudzu. That's actually a good
point. Reminds me of George Carlin, where he talked about how could anybody see something walking sideways on the beach with great big claws and say, I'm going to eat that.
Yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's that having talked to David long enough now to get a sense, feel for his sense of humor, I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't something like that.
We need to make a point to add that to our list of questions just so we don't forget. Even though my folks know he listens to this podcast, I don't know that he listens to every episode all the time, but he will probably hear that question.
Yep.
We may get a written answer back, but we can add that to the list just in case we don't hear back from him. We don't forget that that's something we can ask him. What motivated that choice?
So those are the feedback area aspects that I've got so far, gentlemen.
All right.
And
if we find a few others, we'll toss them in on another episode.
Yep. And I've got to say, the Reddit community, our podcast has kind of helped revive some of the Reddit Honor Harrington community. So
that's awesome.
That's just a cool thing. And again, I think I said this before. One of the things that strikes me interesting is if I talk about our podcast on the Babylon 5 community, it's amazing how much response we get. So
that's because that's another totally cool community.
Yep. And there's a lot of crossover in those two fandoms. So, all right. Any other shout outs, Jim?
No, that's about it. Except a huge thank you to Hank Davis of the TPE Network of fun yet informative podcasts for his hosting of this show. Check out
Hank. Thank that guy enough.
Oh, yeah. Check out Hank's network at tpenetwork.com for great podcasting content. And on our next very exciting episode of The Honorverse Today, we will discuss Call to Vengeance by David Weber, Timothy Zahn, and Thomas Pope. In this story, a monarch is pressured into an uncomfortable position, the fall of a troublesome character, and a villain gets his comeuppance, along with a novel ending in a heck of a cliffhanger.
Oh, man. Oh, man.
Oh, yeah. So
yeah, you guys are gonna like David makes up for this book and that book.
Oh, I already read it. It was fun.
Yeah,
that's as far as I'll say. So, say goodnight, JP.
Good night, JP.
Good night, everybody.
So long, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Honorverse today. We welcome your feedback. Email us at honorverse@tpenetwork.com. We are a proud part of TPE Network. Visit us on the web at honorverse.net, on social media, or tpenetwork.com. You can subscribe to Honorverse today by visiting tpenetwork.com/subscribe. Visit TPE Network for the very best in podcasting. Opinions expressed in the show are solely those of the hosts. They do not reflect the opinions or views of Bain Books, the authors, or TPE Network. Visit Bain.com for the best in science fiction. Many of their books are available from the Bain Free Library found at their site. Theme music is Honor and Sword by Zakhar Valaha. Check his website found in the show notes for all your podcasting music needs.
On Vlachlavek. This chapter was labeled as anti-dispor.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Just diaspora. A note. Yeah, diaspora. Thank you. I don't know why I can't get that. I'll tell you this. If we wait much longer, I'm going to need a bio break.
I just sent that in the chat.
All right.
On Vlachlavek. On Vlachlavek. This chapter was labeled as anti-dispor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anti-dis. All right. Just diaspora. A note. Yeah. Diaspora. Thank you. I don't know why I can't get that. I'll tell you this. If we wait much longer, I'm going to need a bio break.
I just sent that in the chat.
All right.